So we are in a summer preaching series. We started it last week. It's going to go all summer, and it's just called The Questions That Jesus Asked. The Questions That Jesus Asked While He Was On Earth. Questions that are recorded in the gospel, and we're just going to dive right in to one of those questions. Matthew chapter 20, verses 20 and 21. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons, and kneeling down, asked a favor of him. "What is it you want?" he asked. She said, "Grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom." What do you want? I mean, that's one of those questions that almost feels like it's a trap. Yeah, I mean, Jesus asks, "What do you want?" And you feel like, say, is this supposed to be a godly answer, a spiritual answer, or can I tell you what I really want? Because truth be told, what I really want is some credit for all the things I've been doing. What I really want is people to pay attention to me. What I really want is to be a mom, or to have the dark cloud lifted, or to drink less, or to lose a few pounds, or to do my 20s over again. What do I really want? Well, sometimes that's hard to share with other people. But here is a woman who is coming and hearing Jesus ask that question to her. She's the mother of James and John, two guys that have been disciples of Jesus. And she's coming with them in tow because she's got a favor of asking to ask Jesus. You see, her boys have been following Jesus for quite a while now, and like any good mom, she's thinking of what's their future, where's this career track lead, is this going to make them happy? And so she brings and she says, "Jesus, I got a favor," and he looks at her and asks this question, "What do you want?" If Jesus showed up this morning and asked you what you wanted, how would you answer? If Jesus asked you, "What do you want for your kids?" how would you answer? I mean, some of us would say health. Some would say success. Some would say career. Some would say to get into school they're aiming for. Maybe their dreams come true. Some of us would say, "Hey, we're struggling right now, and we just need the basics, food, schools, supplies, shoes." This woman, she responds when asked by Jesus, "What do you want?" She asks for influence and honor and power. She asks for her kids to sit at his right and at his left. She asks for her kids to be a somebody. Now, I believe that with very few exceptions, every parent, mom or dad, every parent loves their kids. That doesn't mean we get it right. That doesn't mean we always express it in the best way. But I think deep down that with few exceptions, every parent loves their kids. And so I believe that's true about this mom. I believe when she asked for success and honor and power, what she was asking for is something out of a heart of love. She was doing it because she thought it would make them happy. She was asking for this because she thought it would make them feel secure. But I just wonder if somewhere deep down in her heart, she wouldn't be able to admit that not only was she asking for something for her kids, that they would be a somebody, but that she was also asking that for herself. That maybe if my kids are a somebody, then maybe I'll be a somebody. I'm sure you saw in the last few months the news stories about the college admission scandals. And how people of great wealth and power and influence were using that wealth to bribe officials to get into certain schools. Some of them elite, some not so much. Felicity Huffman, Lori Loughlin, they're the ones most associated with it just because we know their faces from films and television. But they weren't the only ones. There's a long list. And they would bribe people to take the SAT or ACT for their kids. These people bribed coaches to act as though that these kids were recruited to certain sports teams, even though the kids didn't play those sports. All to try to get their kids into a certain school. And some of it, you know, the bribe kind of made financial, even if immoral, made at least financial sense. But others, it just didn't. They were paying more for admission into a college than that degree could possibly be worth. It's shown that in a lot of the cases, not all, but in a lot of the cases, the kids didn't even know what was happening. Now, again, I believe that every parent loves their kid, and so I'll grant that some of those people are doing it, or all those people are doing it, at least partly because they love their kids, but I wonder if it's not also because they love themselves. And saying their kids went to a certain school wasn't just about the kids, it was so that they could say that they were a success. It doesn't have to be bribing a school. It can be, not always is, but can be as simple as a bumper sticker on the back of your car. You know, my child is an honor student at fill-in-the-blank elementary school. Now, is there anything wrong with being an honor student? Of course not. It's a fantastic thing. Is there anything wrong with having pride in your kid for being an honor student? Of course not. You should be proud. But we're all kind of smart enough to know that there's a ways of doing things that I'm really happy my kid's a success, to kind of show that not only is my kid a success, but I am a parental success. And as evidence, we know that that can at least happen sometimes because of this equally famous bumper sticker: your kid's an honor student, but you're a moron. Now, as kids get older, it becomes a little more sophisticated, and it can be the logo of an elite private school that goes in the back of the windshield. Am I saying that those are always wrong? Of course not. I'm just saying that sometimes it's hard to disentangle our kids' success with our success. What's going on inside of us? A couple years ago, a mom posted on Facebook. It was titled, How to Raise Kids in 2017. How to Raise Kids in 2017. Here's what she wrote. How to Be a Mom in 2017. Make sure your children's academic, emotional, psychological, mental, spiritual, physical, nutritional, and social needs are met, while being careful not to overstimulate, understimulate, improperly medicate, helicopter, or neglect them in a screen-free, processed foods-free, GMO-free, negative energy-free, plastic-free, body-positive, socially conscious, egalitarian but also authoritative, nurturing but fostering of independence, gentle but not overly permissive, pesticide-free, two-story, multilingual home, preferably in a cul-de-sac with a backyard and 1.5 siblings spaced at least 2 years apart for proper development. And also, don't forget the coconut oil. Woo, it's hard. I'm exhausted. Then she added this: how to be a mom in literally every generation before ours? Feed them sometimes. Now that post went viral, and maybe you've seen it because it just makes fun of how ridiculously difficult it is to be a mom or a dad in today's world. I mean, you can't just be a normal human. You've got to have graduated to being God. You've got to be omnipresent with your kids. You have to be omnipotent, able to solve every problem, omniscient, to know what you should do in every conceivable situation. Well, here's the problem. You're not God. And you can't live up to those expectations. So that's how parenting has changed. Feed them sometimes to this really complicated, impossible thing. But I'm curious as to why it changed. Why did it change? Well, remember, I believe that parents love their kids. And so there's no doubt that parenting has changed because parents love their kids and want to do what's best for them. But I'm just asking if it's possible, maybe not, but just possible, that it's not just for our kids, but it's for ourselves. I wonder if having successful kids is a way of saying we are successful. Everybody agrees that kids don't have enough structure, unstructured time. Life is too structured for them. Kids, especially young kids, they need playtime, their own time, free time. But you know the best way to make sure that parents will give their young children playtime, free time? To tell them that if they do, their kids are more likely to be a success. So a guy named Cohen, last name Cohen, wrote a book called The Art of Roughhousing. Now, I don't know exactly what comes to your mind when you think of roughhousing, but art is not what comes to my mind, right? But in it, he cannot resist telling us that if you will let your kids roughhouse, they will have better achievement scores in the first grade. The first grade, it makes my head hurt. First grade achievement scores? Peter Gray at Boston College professor writes this in another place. He says that there are benefits to play, and here they are. Play helps children learn how to make decisions, solve problems, exert self-control, and follow the rules. Learn to regulate their emotions, make friends, learn to get along with others as equals. So see, what we've done is play is another way to succeed. So the message is pretty clear. Go play, kids, and don't mess it up. Don't mess it up because your test scores depend on whether you play the right way. But when we've made play a part of a ladder that we climb to get to success, you know that there is something deeply wrong with us. And I think what was deeply wrong with us is the same thing that is deeply wrong with the mother of James and John. I think it's this, that she was basing, that we base our sense of self on our kids. We get our identity from their identity. See, the mother of James and John is not alone. The human condition is a struggle for righteousness and identity. We want significance. We crave a sense of righteousness, approval, significance, enoughness. We want to be enough. And we're designed to get that from God. But because of sin, we're alienated from God. And therefore, we've gone and tried to find our acceptance and approval and significance and enoughness everywhere but him. Listen to how the Apostle Paul puts it, talking about the Jewish people of his own day. Romans 10:3. For they don't understand God's way of making people right with himself. Refusing to accept God's way, they cling to their own way of getting right with God by trying to keep the law. That verse explains so much about the human condition. God has made a way in Jesus for us to be accepted and loved and enough. But because we've resisted God's way, now what we've done is we've tried our own way to make our own way to be a good enough person. And it's almost impossible to do. Forget the almost. It is impossible to do. Maybe you've seen this meme of Cruella de Vil, the evil character in the Dalmatian movie. She says, me trying to excel in my career, maintain a social life, drink enough water, exercise, text everyone back, stay sane, survive, and be happy. That's the message. You feel like, I can't do it. I can't be enough, do enough, accomplish enough, look good enough, be successful enough, be rich enough, be healthy enough, be woke enough. It's not about parenting. It's about something deeper than that. Because we see this manifested in the workplace. This cartoon made the rounds. It's a picture of a couple on vacation. They're at a beach. The wife is reading a book, and the husband is working on his laptop on the beach. And underneath, it has him saying, I am not a workaholic. I just work to relax. I just work to relax. See, the question is not so much why we work such insane hours. The question is, why do we prefer it? Is it possible that we prefer to work insane hours because we get more from our work than a paycheck? Is it possible that we get our sense of acceptance and approval and significance and enoughness? In the 80s and 90s, the television sitcoms, where'd they take place? They took place in the home. Facts of Life, you know, Family Ties, Roseanne. But where do they take place now? Where do the sitcoms take place now? In the office. The Office, Parks and Rec, 30 Rock. Why? Well, because the office, the work, our career has become the center of our life. It has taken center stage. A woman named Erin Callen had reached, in 2007, she had reached the kind of pinnacle of success. She was either the or one of the most powerful women on Wall Street. She was the CFO of Lehman Brothers. But that year that she was CFO was the year of the worldwide financial crisis. But let's go back in her life and listen to how she talks about her work and her career. She said, I didn't start out with a goal of devoting all of myself to my job. It crept in over time. First, I spent a half hour on Sunday organizing my email, my to-do list, and calendar to make Monday morning easier. Then I was working a few hours on Sunday, and then all day. My boundaries slipped away until work was all that was left. Inevitably, when I left my job, it devastated me. I couldn't just move on. I did not know how to value who I was versus what I did. What I did was who I was. Without the financial crisis, I may never have been strong enough to step away. Perhaps I needed what felt at the time like some of the worst experiences of my life to come to a place where I could be grateful for the life I had. What I did is who I was. What she's saying, my identity, my acceptance, my approval, it was all wrapped up in my career so that it took over my life and I let it because that's where I got my enoughness from. Something is deeply wrong with us. And it's not just family, it's not just work, it's even the ways we reset or rest or recharge. The Wall Street Journal did an article not too long ago, and the title of the article, the headline was Competitive Meditation. You talk about an oxymoron, competitive meditation. And what it says is that in the article it talks about apps like Headspace and Calm. Maybe some of you use them. Headspace and Calm allow you to keep track of how many consecutive days that you've meditated. And you can even set it up so that if you miss a day, it charges your credit card $10. One company that sells an electronic device that you put around your wrist, and it is designed to shock you if you do something wrong. And so it's designed to help you change behaviors, to help you change kind of habits that you have. And if you do it, it'll give you a shock. Well, one of the recommendations is that you would use this shocking device to keep you meditating every day. And people pay $150, $250 to have themselves shocked into meditation. In the article, there's something wrong with this. In the article, there's a Eastern religious kind of expert, and he says this. He says, I'm fairly certain that there is no precedent for this in traditional Buddhist practice. Many monks meditate every day for decades, and I've never heard of anyone keeping track. Now, look, I'm not talking about Eastern meditation. I'm not a big fan, but this could apply to Christian meditation, biblical meditation. And we have here an example of how we take something that's good and is meant to reorient us and put us on the right track and then made it into a ladder that we have to climb in order to feel good about ourselves, to keep track of, because we're only good if we've done it every day in the right way and we've done it more than other people. And we can have you know that I've done it more than other people because I can send you my list of consecutive days and I hope it's bigger than yours. There's something wrong with us. And it has to do with food. Even how we eat is affected by this thing that's wrong with us. It's good to eat healthy. And my family and friends would tell you that I would benefit a lot from healthier eating. But we've taken healthy eating and made it into a religion. There's a thing by the National Eating Disorders that's called, I'm going to mispronounce it, but orthorexia nervosa. It literally means righteous eating. And on the National Eating Disorder Association webpage, here's what it says. Here's what it says. Orthorexia starts out as an innocent attempt to eat more healthfully, but orthorexics become fixated on quality and purity. Every day is a chance to eat right, be good, rise above others in dietary prowess, and self-punish if temptation wins. Self-esteem becomes wrapped up in the purity of the orthorexic's diet. And they sometimes feel superior to others, especially in regard to food intake. It's good to eat healthy. It's smart to eat healthy. Makes sense. But then we've taken it into something where we get our sense of significance from it, and we have to control everything, and we have to be pure, and are you pure enough? And all of a sudden, it starts sounding like religion. Have I been good? Have I been bad? Do I need to punish myself? Do I need to repent? Or do I need to do penance for this? I'm a righteous eater. We all know, I mean, related to food, but we all know that we are told to feel one way or another about ourselves based on what the scale says. That some of us are so wrapped up in what that number says to feel good about ourselves. Back in the 1970s, Oral Roberts University, which is a Christian school, Oral Roberts University, a Christian school, they put in this plan called the Pounds Off Program, that they would not let you graduate, they would not give you a degree unless your body fat was under a certain percentage. And then they ended the program when they remembered that man looks at the outward appearance, but God looks at the heart. There's something deeply wrong with us. We take everything in our world and we make it into some sort of law, right? The problem is not in the things themselves, being a great parent, eating healthy, working and enjoying your work and seeing it as something to God. All these are good things, right? But then we take it and make it into this counter-religion that we're going to get our acceptance, our righteousness, we're going to feel good about ourselves, we're going to be enough by doing all these things, a ladder that we have to climb so that I'm always trying to prove myself to myself, to other people, who knows half the time. But I know this, unless we cast ourselves on the mercy of God, we will always look to other things to give us acceptance and righteousness. Do we eat well enough, live well enough, sleep well enough, do enough, accomplish enough, stay busy enough? The law tells us the more we do, the better we'll be. But it sure doesn't feel like that. See, you can never be enough on your own. Only God can fill that hole. Only God can make you enough. See, grace starts where we surrender. Grace means that instead of me doing, I realize that the gospel is about what Jesus has done. Enoughness, acceptance, approval, significance, it was all secured by Jesus. See, when Jesus says, what do you want? And deep down inside of us, what we're saying we want is to be accepted and enough, and we're going to do it, and we're going to be parental successes. And Jesus goes, no. You can't do that on your own. That's something that only I can give you. It's a gift. I know that we tend to think old things are irrelevant today, but usually they aren't. I doubt anyone here has read the Heidelberg Disputation, something Martin Luther wrote in 1518. But I want to put it up on the screen, and I just want you to think, is this not incredibly relevant to today? Here's question 26. The law says, do this, and it is never done. Grace says, believe in this, and everything is already done. See, the law says, keep doing, but it'll never be enough. I can't eat healthy enough. I can't be enough of a parental success. I can't work enough. I can't do enough. It's never done. But believe in Jesus. Believe that he is the one who makes us righteous and accepted and loved and forgiven. See, I don't have to be enough because Jesus was enough for me. What I need to do is run to Jesus and rest in his enoughness. It's a gift, not what I do, but what he did for me. As the music team comes back, will you pray with me? Just pause for a second and just say, Lord, show me what area of my life I'm trying to base my enoughness on? Is it my parenting? Or is it my work? Or is it the way I look and my workouts and the scale? Where am I seeking acceptance from the law of trying to do enough instead of just believing in the promise of Jesus that he is enough and that I'm loved and accepted in him? Oh, Jesus, we are exhausted from chasing righteousness apart from you. We are exhausted from living life apart from you. And so, Jesus, by your grace, we just come to you and say, you're my enoughness. You're my acceptance. You're my approval. You are my righteousness. What good news that is for our weary souls. Help us to believe it, Jesus. Amen.